for listening to my podcast. In this episode, I talk about when economics became a social science, economic growth, and about what changed in the course of human history that may drive human betterment. By the end, I hope you're asking yourself, is human betterment a continuous process? And what can we do to keep building a world where each generation is better off than the last? Hope you enjoy. The foundation of modern economics is usually attributed to Adam Smith, a Scottish philosopher who lived in the middle of the 1700s in both Scotland and England at different periods during his life. Now, Adam Smith is particularly known for writing two books. He wrote more than just these two books, but the two books that he's most well known for are first, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which today is probably read by more philosophers than it is economists, although it's becoming more popular in the field. And then the second is called An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, or The Wealth of Nations for short. Now, The Wealth of Nations was originally published in 1776, although Smith went on during the course of his life to revise it six more times until ultimately the time of his death in the 1790s. Now, even though economists or historians of ideas usually attribute the foundation of modern economics to Smith, that's not to say that economic ideas didn't exist prior to Smith. In fact, Smith in The Wealth of Nations is challenging the predominant economic idea of his time called mercantilism. Now, mercantilism, in a very basic sense, is the idea that exports are good, that imports are bad, and that in order for a country to get rich, all they've got to do is increase their exports, limit their imports, and import as much gold or silver or other money as possible. And what Smith is doing when he comes on the scene is he says, look, this idea is completely backwards. And in fact, what creates opulence or what drives economic growth is not what we would call paying attention to this trade imbalance, but rather that people should do what they do best and trade for the stuff that they're not very good at. In other words, they should pay attention to what their comparative advantage is. And the reason why this is so important and the reason why we usually think of Smith as the founder of modern economics is that this idea that he was challenging, mercantilism, really was not just the predominant idea during the middle of the 1700s, but came on the scene much earlier than that. It's usually dated back to the middle of the 14th century, around 1380, and it doesn't change all that much between the middle of the 14th century and Smith's day. So even though there were different strings of mercantilism, and there were definitely different mercantilist thinkers, the main idea, this main premise that really what you've got to worry about is increasing your exports and importing money, doesn't change very much over that period. And ultimately, the mercantilist thinkers, although they debated with each other, did not evolve their ideas or didn't build on the sophistication of the mercantilist model, which, in fact, for folks who are paying attention, this may sound an awful lot like some of the economic ideas that are actually coming out of the current administration, where they're saying in the United States at least we need to focus on increasing exports and reducing imports or dealing with the current trade imbalance. So the other reason why historians of ideas or economists usually attribute the foundation of modern economics to Smith is that he really kicks off this revolution of thinking about how countries grow, like what drives economic growth, what creates rich countries and what creates poor countries, where does wealth come from? This other idea that Smith deals with in his books that also catches on and begins to become explored over time by other scholars and is still studied today is this concept of the theory of value. So why are some things valued more than other things? What drives the value of commodities? What drives the value of labor? And even though some of the general principles are that Smith talked about and that other contemporaries of Smith or near contemporaries of Smith talked about and developed, are still present today in the field, our view on these issues is much more sophisticated based on the exploration that has occurred over the last couple of hundred years. So it's sort of, if you think about physics, it's sort of the same way that, you know, gravity, or at least the concepts of gravity, hasn't changed all that much since Sir Isaac Newton first developed a theory of gravity. But ultimately, over time, our understanding of gravity and how gravity works has evolved quite significantly. It's the same thing when we think about economic growth and this theory of value. Our understanding of those concepts today, even though some of the basic principles are timeless, or folks agree with some of the basic principles that were derived very early on in the revolution of economics as a social science, are the same. Our understanding of those things are much more sophisticated than they once were. Another major change in the field that's occurred since Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations 250 years ago is that economists have had the benefit of being able to study the last 300 years of near continuous economic growth in a large part of the world. So if you look at human experience over the very long run, especially human experience before 1700, economic growth was not the norm. Economic stagnation was the norm. So if you were born before 1700, the likelihood that your standard of living was very similar to your parents' standard of living or your grandparents' standard of living or your great-grandparents' standard of living or even your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents' standard of living was very high. Compare that to today, when the standard of living of folks who were born in 2000 is significantly different than the standard of living for folks who were born in 1900 or even 1800. So it's probably safe to say that if you look at the long run in human history, economic growth is not a continuous process, even though we've come to count on it as a continuous process in our everyday lives. So we plan for economic growth, we plan for continued innovation and continued technology, we plan for it in the public policy that our government engages in. But in the end, it's not clear that economic growth will always be with us. It's probably just as likely that the economic growth will end one day as it will continue. So if you look at the economic growth that's occurred over the last 300 years, most of it is attributable to three different periods. The first is called the First Industrial Revolution, where we saw great advances in both steam and rail technology. The second period is called the Second Industrial Revolution, which is defined by electricity, the internal combustion engine, chemical developments, and improved communications. The third period is called the Third Industrial Revolution, really innovative here, which is defined by computers and the connection of networks and information through the internet and robotics. So it's unlikely that the technologies that were created during the Industrial Revolution are alone responsible for the sustained economic growth that we've experienced over the last 300 years. This is true even if the economic growth that occurred along with any of the Industrial Revolutions can be traced back to any or all of those technologies. So to see what I mean, it's again, I think, helpful to look at the very long-run view of human history and to ask, what is different today relative to before 1700? So in other words, is there anything that is that's new that ultimately has driven or helped to drive the significant increase in betterment that we've experienced more recently in human history? So there's an economist at the University of Illinois Chicago named Deirdre McCloskey who has, I think, a particularly interesting perspective on this, in that Deirdre believes that at some point around 1700, and in fact she actually thinks that it started a little bit before that period, maybe in the 1500s or 1600s, people stopped being hostile towards other people who were pushing out the production possibilities frontier. In other words, our ancestors around that time stopped attacking people who were actually driving or creating the economic growth. And even more importantly, according to McCloskey, it was that people stopped being hostile towards ordinary people who were creating stuff and then selling it to improve their lives and other people's lives as well. And so the emphasis there is on ordinary. So you didn't have to be part of the clergy or the ruling class to have a good idea and get rich. So some people may call this freedom, but ultimately I think it's a little bit more specific than that. Going from there, there are others who have proposed that these concepts that were important during the Enlightenment, such as freedom and equality, were also important in driving the sustained economic growth that we've seen happen over the last 300 years. However, I think that there's a larger question there, at least when one starts to dig a little bit deeper about what kinds of freedom and equality existed at the period in which we saw a rise in growth. So in other words, freedom, if again you look at the very long-run view of human history, is this irregularity. And the world is much more free today than it was when the Industrial Revolution revolutions took off. I mean, in fact, it's much more free, especially for certain groups. For instance, if you're an African American in the United States, the world is more free today than it was in 1960, than it was in 1900, than it was in 1850, and ultimately as it was when the Industrial Revolution took off. The same can be said for equality. So the world today is much more equal than it was when the Industrial Revolution took off, and is likely more equal than it even was 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And so economic growth, as Smith would say, has created opulence. It's helped us eradicate disease and reduce real suffering from material hardships. And importantly, it's helped us specialize in what we're good at. At least it's just allowed humans to specialize what we're good at, which is what's between our ears. And perhaps more importantly, economic growth has helped us to afford freedoms and to afford equality. So the freedom to work, think tanks, the freedom to attack slavery, the freedom to spend an unbelievable amount of time thinking about what determines economic growth and producing podcasts, and the freedom to pursue ultimately a world that the folks who helped get the Industrial Revolution started could only dream about, or maybe not.